This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. World travel, climate change, and misuse of antibiotics has created new opportunities for disease. This summer, the Zika virus, spread by mosquitoes and previously unknown here, is cause for concern, not just at the Summer Olympics in Brazil, which appears to be the epicenter of the outbreak, but here in the United States, where hundreds of people returning from trips abroad have brought the virus home with them. And this year, a superbug has arrived on our shores, raising fears that we may be approaching the end of the age of antibiotics. A frightening prospect. So this hour, we take a closer look at both and at preparations being taken by Mecklenburg County to protect against Zika. Dr. Marcus Plesha is Health Director of the Mecklenburg County Health Department. Welcome back.
Thank you.
See you. And he's with us in our Spirit Square studio along with Dr. Kate Passeretti, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Carolina's Healthcare System. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. Get a little closer to these microphones. Don't be shy. It is your best friend in the room. Let's start with Zika. Where did the virus come from? I mean, we never heard of this virus before this year, so where did it come from?
It's actually been around for quite a while. We just didn't notice that it causes relatively mild symptoms and wasn't picked up until recently when they saw a rise in rates of fetal birth defects and associated it back with this virus in South and Central America.
Well, I read it yesterday that it was discovered in 1947 in a rhesus monkey, and yet we've never heard of it. I guess the better question is, why now are we hearing so much about it? Why now does it seem to be exploding, not only in the news, but among individuals who are now affected by it?
Well, I think that's because it's spread, and so we're starting to see it in other parts of the world.
But why?
Well, that's what happens with these infectious diseases. You know, we live in a society now where things can spread more easily. We get around. We move around the world, and
But we've had airline travel since the 1940s, actually, I guess. We've had heavy use of airlines to get around since the 70s and 80s. Why now?
That's, you know, we often don't know why now for certain things. I guess it reached a critical level in the areas in Africa where we were seeing it, and it made the jumps somehow with somebody into South America, and so now we have it on the same continent with us, and I think that's causing a great deal of anxiety. It also, as Dr. Passeretti mentioned, you know, the fact that we are now clearly seeing birth defects that are related to infection with Zika is, I think, the thing that has caused the greatest concern.
But there were previous outbreaks of this in Micronesia and French Polynesia, but they were much smaller outbreaks, and the current outbreak has microcephaly associated with it. But I'm told in those previous outbreaks, they didn't connect those dots. Was that because there was no microcephaly or because they simply didn't see the connection?
I think it's more likely that simply didn't see the connection before now, that it's likely this has been around for some time and it's just kind of flying under the radar. We didn't notice the association, and now it's come to a critical mass where the huge rates of microcephaly that were picked up in South America have brought it to international attention.
And was it just this year that they've seen these rates of microcephaly explode in South America, particularly around Brazil, or is that something that's been there for a while? They just never associated with the Zika virus.
Really, over the past couple of years is when they've seen the huge increases. And when they look back at countries as the spread has continued throughout different countries, you know, every week there's a new country that they're finding Zika virus transmission in. When they look back, there are some cases that were likely associated that weren't picked up.
This microcephaly, for those who maybe not, I can't imagine people don't know because it's been in the news for so many weeks, but let's just talk about what goes on there. The virus gets into the mother's system through a mosquito bite, and it travels to the fetus, and it consumes the neurological matter in the developing fetus. Is that what goes on?
Well, I don't know that we completely know the mechanism, how Zika interacts with the fetal brain, but what we do know is that the result are children with very small brains, various birth defects, vision and hearing defects on the outside. I think there's a lot of research that's going on trying to figure out exactly how that interplay and that transmission occurs.
What happens to these children as they go through life?
So the, you know, obviously the birth defects can have huge implications for the children later on in life. You know, learning defects, vision defects, hearing defects, those are all things that carry on throughout the child's life. So there can be significant limitations
Would you describe them as when they become older, are they functioning individuals or will they need care for their entire lives?
With any kind of disease, there's a spectrum, right? So some children have more severe birth defects, some have lesser defects. So I don't think you can generalize necessarily that, you know, every child with Zika is going to be dependent for care for the rest of their life. It just depends on how that child, the virus acts on that particular child.
But microcephaly, you know, is a very concerning birth defect. I mean, I think that is the reason that people are apprehensive about this. There's lots of different kinds of birth defects, but
right.
microcephaly, because as you mentioned, it's affecting the neurological system. I mean, there is the potential for much more devastating effects than with other things that we sometimes see.
So far, there have been a few hundred cases of this virus reported by people in the U.S., including 11 in North Carolina, 2 in Mecklenburg County. None of these cases were locally acquired. These were all travelers who went to other parts of the world. How do we know that? That's what we were told. So how do we know that?
Well, I think the epidemiologic look back in the cases, all of these people within a reasonable time frame prior to either their symptoms or the testing time period had traveled to an area where we have known transmission. Is that 100%? No, but because we haven't seen in non-travelers any disease, that's highly suggestive that we're bringing into the country, but we haven't seen transmission yet from person to person within the country.
But it is transmissible from person to person. It's not just transmissible through mosquito bites, right?
Yes, it's transmissible.
That makes it even more troubling, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's transmissible three ways, through mosquito bites, through sexual contact, and then across a woman's placenta to a fetus, which mm-hmm. we talked about just now.
Go ahead.
And there have been cases of pure sexual transmission, so where the individual hasn't necessarily traveled to the affected area but had sex with someone who had traveled, had symptoms, and had developed Zika.
Is the discovery that it is transmissible through sex a recent discovery?
Since this whole outbreak occurred, so I'd say over the past 4 or 5 months when it really became clear.
But this has been around since 1947. Why are we just discovering that now?
But it's been around in populations that don't have great access to medical care, that aren't as closely monitored as we were, you know, in the past, the ability to kind of do broad look backs at disease processes in countries, third world countries, has been limited. So I really think it's a function of now it's coming to more developed countries.
So we're going to I'm sorry.
We are really learning a lot about it. I mean, when we first began to look at Zika here, there was a question about, is microcephaly the result of the Zika infection, or could it just be chance?
Mm-hmm,
So even that early on was questionable, and I think we have pretty definitive information now that that's true. We have pretty definitive information now about sexual transmission, but this is a virus and an infection that we're really learning a lot about as we go along.
We're going to talk about mosquitoes in a second, but let's talk about, since it's transmitted sexually, let's talk about that. Should you use the same precautions that you would use if you were trying not to get a sexually transmitted disease or HIV?
Yes, precautions? Yes, the same precautions.
But this is transmitted, as I understand it, people who are bitten by this mosquito or who get this virus from another person. It is for men, it's in their semen. It's also in saliva. It's in your blood. So is that also the case with HIV? Is it in your saliva? Is it transmissible through saliva?
No, it's with HIV we really focus on transmission through semen.
Yeah.
With Zika virus, I think we are, as I said, we're learning as we go along. But right now the clear correlation is that it's passed through sexual activity.
It's also in urine, I understand. Is it transmissible through urine? I mean, if you were to, you know, come in contact with someone else's infected urine, would you perhaps get the virus? Or do we know? Is that ridiculous?
I don't think we know completely. You know, you're right. Urine is one of the body substances we test for patients with Zika, and we know there is virus in it. But there's been no indication, clear indication anyway, that urine could be a transmissible body site, that it's transmitted in. There's been no indication in public bathrooms, things like that.
So just the normal precautions, wash your hands, et cetera.
Okay. That's correct, yes.
This virus, obviously, as we've talked about, is also spread by mosquitoes. And in January, health officials were reporting that only one type of mosquito, I'm going to say this incorrectly, the Aedes aegypti, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Were known for sure to carry the virus. And those were common only in the very southernmost states, South Florida, South Texas, Louisiana, and Hawaii. Is that still the case?
We think it is. Now, if there are maps that have mapped out the possible habitat for Aedes aegypti, and those maps do include North Carolina, so there's the potential to have it in North Carolina. But we do surveillance for mosquitoes here in Mecklenburg County. The state does that as well. The state's efforts had fallen off a bit, but they've come back up. So we go out and catch mosquitoes and test to see what they are, and we have not seen aegypti here in many years.
This thing does very well in tropical environments. Is that because that's where that mosquito does very well, or is it because viruses like this tend to do well in warmer, humid climates?
Well, they do. What's interesting about this virus, though, is it's very adapted to human beings. It likes to go into homes. You will find these mosquitoes in houses. It doesn't go out and breed in swamps like we think a mosquito is doing. It likes to find little containers in your backyard, mm-hmm. like your flower pots, and breed there. It's very familiar with humans. It prefers to bite humans than any other mammal or bird, unlike other mosquitoes. So although it comes from the tropics, this relationship with human beings is a little different for a mosquito.
Yeah. I read yesterday that these mosquitoes like to be around people so much that they're like pets. Would it be possible for an infected person to be bitten by a mosquito not known for carrying this virus? And then for that mosquito to, because they have ingested your blood, be carrying the virus so that they could then infect another person. Is that possible?
Yes, that's what I think the concern is. The infection with Zika, often people have a pretty mild, if any, symptoms. And so someone could very well have been infected with Zika and not be aware of it. And in that case, if they wouldn't be taking any precautions, they could easily be bitten and passed to somebody else. So I think that's what we're concerned about. I don't know if you have other thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the virus seems to have a proclivity for this specific type of mosquito. But if there's that type of circulating mosquito around, someone gets bit, obviously the concern is that we'd start to see transmission here, especially in the areas with heavier population.
Why does this virus have a proclivity for this particular mosquito? Is it simply because of all the factors we've talked about, that this mosquito likes to be around people, this mosquito likes to feed on people, this mosquito generally is in tropical areas where people are close together and it's hot and it thrives? Is that why, or are there other factors that come into play, or do we even understand?
I think those are all factors. I mean, certain mosquitoes carry certain diseases. There are other mosquitoes that we have here in Mecklenburg County that, for example, West Nile virus is carried by a different mosquito. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure why some have a proclivity towards one virus, others have a proclivity towards another. But mosquitoes, historically, mosquitoes have carried all kinds of diseases, the most famous probably being malaria.
And these mosquitoes are not affected by the virus themselves, correct? The biggest worry, of course, is the birth defect issue, the microcephaly issue. Is it true that in every case in which a pregnant woman might be bitten by a mosquito carrying the virus, that the fetus will be affected? Or is that not always the case?
No, I don't think that's always the case. There's definitely an association, but it's like any virus. Some people get bit and have repercussions from the virus, but some people tolerate it for whatever reason, whether their immune system, they have particular antibodies, whatever. But not every woman bit by this mosquito that has a virus would necessarily have birth defects in their fetus.
We recently saw data that 5 to 15% of women who are infected with Zika who are pregnant would pass it on and have microcephaly. Those are new numbers, but as we said, we're learning.
We'll talk more about that, and we'll get around to this new superbug, which is frightening, in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nantahala Outdoor Center, offering mountaintop zip line tours with panoramic views of the Smokies. More at NOC.com. And British International School of Charlotte, dedicated to unleashing the potential of every child through its personal approach, international curriculum, and campus of 42 schools around the globe. BISCharlotte.org. Summer is here. You may have noticed the temperatures changed, huh? Beach time, but this year you don't have to drive hours to get to a beach. Over the Memorial Day weekend, a public beach opened on Lake Norman, allowing access to the lake to those who don't own property there. We're going to hear about the first county park in 40 years to allow swimming and how more of those parks could be on the way. And then it's on to some beach reading. Park Road Book Sally Brewster shares her thoughts on cool reads for hot summer days, all on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, Fed Chair Janet Yellen speaks following a weak jobs report for May, an update on the state of the U.S. economy, interest rates, employment, and prospects for wage growth.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Marcus Plescia, Health Director from Mecklenburg County's Health Department, and Dr. Kay Passeretti, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Carolina's Healthcare System. We're talking about Zika. We're going to move on a little bit later on to this new superbug that has presented itself in this country, and which is impervious to antibiotics, which is a very, very scary thing. 6 months ago, there was some question about this connection between Zika and microcephaly, and we have now concluded that there is definitely a connection. How did we reach that conclusion?
Epidemiological studies. I mean, we really started looking at the numbers and analyzing the people who were infected with Zika who were pregnant, and some of it is a statistical analysis, which is always hard to explain. Right. But, you know, as we had more cases and more information about those cases, the numbers essentially added up in a way that we're pretty confident now that there is an association between the two.
Is there more danger of being bitten at certain stages of a fetus's development than at others, or is it always a danger?
So they'll say that getting bitten at any stage of pregnancy is a risk, but the fetus is developing most in the earlier stages of pregnancy. So I think the general thought is that, you know, getting bitten in the first or second trimester, and especially earlier on, would have bigger repercussions on the fetus.
So that would mean if you are having sex with an infected male, or if you yourself have it before you are pregnant, that would be a danger, a red flag.
Right. So they warn women traveling to affected areas to kind of avoid trying to become pregnant for at least 8 weeks after they travel to those areas, because it could become an issue if the woman became pregnant soon after she had traveled to an affected area. And similar with sexual precautions, you know, if there's recommendations to use safe sex for up to 8 weeks after travel.
Why 8 weeks? Why is that the magic number?
And there's been that number is a little bit of a moving target as we figure out more. You know, the virus is thought to hang out in the blood for a maximum of 2 weeks. We don't know how long it hangs out in other protected body sites. What we do know is that all the cases of sexual transmission so far have come from men who have symptoms of the disease, not men without symptoms, and that the highest risk period seems to be earlier on. So they kind of doubled in that time period to kind of provide what they think is a measure of safety.
Is there a blood or a saliva or a urinalysis test that can detect it in a person?
Yeah, there's two tests. One is able to detect the virus immediately. The other is a immunologic test that shows that the body has been exposed to the virus, and which test we use sort of depends on when the patient is presenting. One of the challenges is early on, the first test could only be done by the Centers for Disease Control, so we had to ship samples down there, and it took a while. Mm-hmm. Now we've got the capacity to do that at our state lab as well.
Okay. I read yesterday that 80% of the people who are infected don't know it. They're asymptomatic. They have no symptoms whatsoever. So when you have symptoms, what are they?
So fever, rash, muscle aches, and red eyes are kind of the four big symptoms that you worry about, or some combination of those are most typically seen.
And why is it that 80% of the people walk around have no symptoms, don't know they were bitten? It's as though nothing has happened. Why is that?
And that kind of gets back to the conversation earlier about not every pregnant woman that's bitten will have fetal birth defects. So different people fight off viruses in different ways, have symptoms. So it's actually not the most effective virus at causing illness. A lot of people really don't feel any effects.
I mean, it's a good thing in a lot of ways. I think there's a lot of apprehension and concern about Zika because of the issue with birth defects, but I think people need to remember, for a lot of people, this is a self-limited disease, something you may not even know that you had. So compared to some other mosquito-borne diseases we've seen, this is a little different.
So if you're planning to get pregnant, this is the scary part of this. Mm-hmm. It's summertime. People, there are mosquitoes all over the place. You get bitten. You don't know whether the mosquito you were bitten by is a carrier of this disease. how would you know to be cautious? Simply because you or your partner went to Brazil or to some other country? Where are the countries that you should be – what areas of the world should you be concerned about?
Well, right now I think the biggest area to be cautious about is if you're traveling. And I would recommend people go on the CDC website and they'll give the advisories of what countries we consider to be high prevalence and high risk for Zika. At this point, with us not having any history of mosquito transmission in the United States – when you're here, if you're not traveling, there's really not any reason to.
So even though South Florida, South Texas, Louisiana, and a few other places have been mentioned as places that are friendly to these mosquitoes, and in fact do have these mosquitoes that carry this virus, those mosquitoes may not yet have come in contact with that virus,
That's correct.
But if you are a traveler and you went to Brazil and you were bitten by a mosquito carrying this, and you go to South Florida and are bitten again by a mosquito of that variety that could carry this virus but is not yet carrying that virus, are they now carrying that virus?
Right, so that's the concern, that it could get into the mosquito population in those areas from a returning traveler and then start spreading from here in that same chain. So I think that's the biggest concern.
If you are infected once, can you be infected again, or does your body build up immunity to this and immediately ward it off?
I think in general the thought is once you're infected, you're protected against future future infections. Having said that, you know, viruses, bacteria mutate over time, and whether at some point it may be able to mutate. But right now the general thinking is that no, you can't get reinfected.
Okay. James on Twitter writes, in Africa, Zika has been shown to be carried by a wide variety of mosquitoes in the genus Aedes, if that's how you say it. Here in Charlotte, we have the Asian tiger mosquito, which is one of those mosquitoes. Should we be concerned about that?
So that one is called Aedes albopictus, which is the even more challenging name. And yes, we do have that one without question. So that is what our concern is here, and that is why we have begun to take some activities to try to control those mosquitoes. Now, we don't think that the transmission is as effective with that mosquito as the Aegypti, which is where we're seeing most of the transmission. But it is possible. This is a good question, and this is why this is a little more relevant to us and not just relevant to states further south from us.
So why is this particular mosquito more susceptible to being able to carry this than other mosquitoes?
Well, they're a similar type of mosquito. They're both out of this class of Aedes, so they have a lot of similarities. And whatever it is about Aegypti that makes Aegypti a good host for Zika is probably similar for albopictus.
Why is Brazil seemingly the epicenter of this current outbreak?
I think part of it is the attention that's been paid to Brazil recently with the Olympics going there. You know, the climate is perfect for this type of mosquito. The virus is prevalent there. I don't think we completely know why it seems to be hit particularly hard, but we are finding, as we look harder, other places have higher rates than initially thought as well. So it may just be the focus on that particular area right now.
Can a person effectively protect themselves from mosquito bites?
Yes. Yes, there's a lot we can do. And, you know, I do want to make the point that we are, we being your health department, are concerned about this and are beginning to take some action along those lines. So to answer your question, I mean, people can do what we always do to protect ourselves from mosquito bites, which is wear long sleeve shirts, long pants, and use mosquito repellent. That will keep them from biting you. You can also stay inside. We are lucky in this country that most people have air conditioning and most people have screens on their windows. One of the big challenges in some of the tropical areas is a lot of people don't have air conditioners. They got to open the windows up to stay cool. They don't have screens. So these mosquitoes are kind of having at it. We're in a very different situation here. The other thing we can do is we can control the mosquito population, and we do that we do that by going after the mosquito larvae. We can kill the larvae in the places where they're breeding, or most important, we can get everybody engaged in going out into their backyard and dumping out little pots of water. That's where they breed. That could make a big difference.
And that's what one of the things that you're encouraging people to do. And you're talking about doing this once a week. Take a little trip around your yard and dump out anything that might have water in it, like what, little planters?
Flower pots. Even flower pots. A flower pot, even the little pot at the bottom of the flower pot that catches the water. If you've got water sitting around there, the big thing that people don't think about is their gutters. If your gutters aren't draining properly, you can have water sitting up in them. They like these little containers. They don't want to go off into the swamps. They want to actually breed in your little cooler that's got a little water collected in it. That's where they like to go. And it is very easy to just tip that water out and that's the end of them. If your neighbor is doing this, you can encourage your neighbor to go clean things up. If your neighbor is not participating, you can give us a call and we'll come out and have a look at things. So
really?
This is something we're very serious
about. Can you force
them
to do that?
Yes, we can. We haven't gone to that length yet, but we do. You know, if we have places that we think are particularly hazardous as far as standing water, we do have the ability to require that be cleaned.
How far from their habitat do mosquitoes fly? I mean, if you clean up your yard and you're very careful about it, and therefore you have no opportunities for mosquitoes to breed in your yard, but the next door neighbor or the neighbor next door to that neighbor isn't doing such a good job. Is a mosquito from their yard likely to come into your yard and bite you?
Well, that is possible. I mean, they're going to fly as little as they have to get what they want, so they may tend to stay in the neighbor's yard. But I would say if you're doing your due diligence in your backyard and somebody next to you isn't, that also poses a risk for you, and you should talk to your neighbors about it. There's good reasoning for doing this. You're protecting them as well as yourself and your other neighbors.
It's something as small as a bottle cap can be a breeding ground for these mosquitoes. So what about things like bird baths? A lot of people have bird baths in their backyard.
It's a good idea to dump a bird bath out about once a week. Now, bird baths, because birds get in there and splash around and make the water ripple. Water that's it's stagnant water that mosquitoes like. If the water's moving around, it's not good for the larvae. So bird baths may be okay, but we recommend that people just freshen them up once a week.
So fountains aren't a problem because the water's moving
around.
What about these little ponds that people have, koi ponds and things like that?
Well, so if the water's moving and there's fish, you've got the water movement, and then
fish
like
the
mosquito
larvae.
So that's... You know, that's good.
Which repellents should we be spraying on ourselves, and how dangerous is it to be spraying yourself with repellent?
There's a lot of repellents now, and I suggest people can go on to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency website, and you can get the full list. Mm-hmm. We have traditionally talked about insecticides that contain DEET, D-E-E-T. That certainly works very well, but there are others now as well. They are safe to use. Sometimes in very young children, you'd have to look depending on which one, but they are safe to use in pregnant women, and that's very important.
Okay. Can a single bite from a mosquito transmit this disease, or do you have to be bitten several times by that same mosquito or by other mosquitoes carrying this disease?
No, a single bite can do it. It's just that transmission of blood from the mosquito into your body.
Wow. So if a mosquito lights on your skin or sits on your skin, can you assume that it's bitten you already? Because you don't really feel it while they're biting you. You feel it later. Can you assume that it's bitten you? I'm trying to get a handle on this, I guess.
Well, these mosquitoes are sneaky. They kind of sneak up on you, and you may not realize you've been bitten. You know, you've got to walk that line between being afraid of every bug that's out there and being reasonable. I think if you're doing reasonable things to protect yourself, wearing mosquito repellent when you're in kind of outdoorsy, higher risk situations where there's a lot of water around, that's the best thing you can do.
In January, Johns Hopkins University reported that this virus was spreading explosively. Is that because of climate change? Is it because of an increase in world travelers? Is it because it started in a third world country where people are very close together? And as you say, these mosquitoes that transmit this like to be in these environments, and perhaps sanitation isn't what it could or should be in those places. What's going on here?
It's probably all of those things and others that we don't understand. I mean, we're just seeing a lot more, as you started the conversation with, we're seeing a lot more of these kind of things crop up and then spread very quickly, and that's the case with this one.
There's no vaccine for Zika. Right. Is anybody working on one?
Yeah, they are working on it, just none that are ready for prime time yet.
How long does that usually take to develop? A long time?
Yeah, it can take a long time.
President Obama asked Congress for $1.9 billion to help scientists develop better diagnostic tools and mosquito control strategies. Congressional Republicans have said that his request is too broad. So far, nothing has been done. So who's right? Do we need $1.9 billion to fight this little bug? Or are the Republicans right that we could do it with far less? And they have suggested, less than $1 billion for this.
Well, we need to prepare for these kinds of things. As you have mentioned, you know, this is the particular infectious disease that we're talking about today. You know, last summer we could have been talking about Ebola. I mean, these things just keep cropping up over and over again. And the infrastructure has fallen off. I mean, the public health infrastructure is not what it once was. And I think we are at some risk that, you know, I don't know that it's going to be Zika, but we are at some risk that at some point we could have a pretty robust infectious disease cycle here in the United States that would be difficult for us to control.
Part of the problem, I think, you just mentioned Ebola, and that was we were consumed by news of Ebola for a long period of time, a couple of months, and then it's just completely disappeared. And you wonder whether that's the media driving the news cycle or the news cycle driving the media to report it. I'm not sure which is the proper way to say it, but we fixate on certain things that may or may not be serious problems, and then they disappear. So that leads one to believe that this is going to disappear, and this really isn't the problem that it's cracked up to be because it's driving the news cycle, which is true.
I think those of us who work in this field worry that at some point there's going to be a tipping point where it's not going to disappear and it's going to take off and it's going to cause a considerable amount of suffering. I mean, there's just too many things to show how that could happen.
Is this like the boy who cried wolf? We cry wolf one too many times, and when the real wolf arrives, we just ignore it?
Well, that is a concern that could happen, and I think some of the discussion around, you know, when you fund, when you resource various types of activities like public health, I mean, once you have the resources there, we have the ability to respond to a lot of things. So maybe they respond to Zika, and it means there are some more resources, and maybe Zika doesn't blow up, but it does mean we are that much better prepared for whatever the next thing might be.
I'm not sure exactly when the president asked for $1.9 billion, but one scientist has said that waiting 3 months, and I think it's probably been longer than that, waiting 3 months for a decision during an epidemic is an eternity. What are the dangers of the wait time? Why is waiting a problem? Because it could spread beyond our ability to control it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the longer you wait, the more potential there is to spread to other areas. I mean, just in the past couple of months, the number of countries that have been added as areas of Zika transmission have exploded. You know, we started out with a couple. Now there's about 50 different countries where there's clear transmission.
The biggest weapon, as you said, that we have in our arsenal at this point in time, I guess, is to make sure that our own yards are not hospitable to mosquitoes. So your organization, the Mecklenburg County Health Department, has been taking some measures. What have you been doing?
So when we began hearing about Zika virus, we actually, you know, we don't know whether we're going to see the Zika virus here in North Carolina this summer. But our approach was, well, let's take some precautions. So the main thing we did is we brought on additional staff this summer to work in mosquito control. Mosquitoes are pesty. They're not well-liked, so we thought if there were less mosquitoes around, people would be happy. But in the case of Zika, you know, if we can do some things to really lower the overall population early, you know, that just gets us out ahead of it. We are doing more work to make sure the public are aware of how important it is to deal with these things in your backyard. Go out there and dump out that standing water.
Okay. Dr. Marcus Plusher from the Mecklenburg County Health Department. We're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about Zika, but also about this superbug. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, formerly Bradley Arant Bolt Cummings, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte, partnering through all phases of a project. The name has changed, but dedication to client service remains. Bradley.com. Fed Chair Janet Yellen speaks following a weak jobs report for May. We'll get an update on the state of the U.S. economy, a look at interest rates, employment, and prospects for wage growth coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it now at charlottetalks at WFAE.org, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook. You can get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
This is Ira Glass, and I'm coming to town to do this show that I know sounds totally ridiculous, but I swear is pretty great. It's a collaboration between me and the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company. So I tell stories, they tell me. they dance, two art forms that have no business being together on stage, now together. It killed at Carnegie Hall. I hope I see you there.
Coming to the Bell Theater, Saturday, June 25th at 8 p.m. Details and tickets at BlumenthalArts.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Zika virus. We're going to move on in a second to this superbug that is antibiotic resistant. We're talking with Dr. Kate Passeretti, who's the Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Carolina's Healthcare System, and Dr. Marcus Plesha, Health Director for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. Rebecca emails, what are the risks for non-pregnant teen girls heading south for post-graduation beach trips? If they are infected now, would there be any impact on a much later pregnancy?
They don't think so. We don't think so right now. The risk really is if you travel while you're pregnant or right before you become pregnant.
So if they're 17, 18 years old and they're not going to get pregnant until they're 22, 23, 24?
No, they'll be just fine as far as we know.
Okay. Health experts have said that a Zika outbreak is unlikely in North Carolina, and that if we did have one, it would likely be far milder than what they are experiencing in more tropical zones. Why?
Well, some of it has to do with the kind of mosquito we have. We have the albopictus and not the aegypti. And so the feeling is that that particular mosquito is not as effective at transmitting the virus. We also, you know, although this infection has traveled significantly across different continents, it has taken time for each of those steps. Mm-hmm. If we started to see Zika activity in the southern United States, I would be a lot more worried about whether we might start seeing it in North Carolina. But I think until that were to happen, right now we feel that the chance of having it in North Carolina is low. Now, that, you know, as I said, our approach is to prepare for it as best we can, and that's what we're trying to do.
At the height of the cankerworm problem, either the city or the county, I don't know which, I can't remember now, sprayed. They had airplanes flying all over the city in the most heavily infested areas, spraying to kill the cankerworms. Any plans on the part of the county or the city or the state, for that matter, to spray for mosquitoes?
The main way of fighting mosquitoes is to kill the larva, and you do that by applying larvicidal ingredients into water where they breed. So there's little kind of pills you can drop in there. There's a fine oil you can put in there. It kills the larvae, and that's the most effective way to control mosquito populations, and it's pretty non-toxic because you don't have it floating around in the air where other people are breathing.
What about these mosquito spraying services? Well, you'll drive through neighborhoods and you'll see yard signs saying somebody sprayed my yard for mosquitoes. Is that not effective then?
Well, I think the verdict is out on that. Those systems, they work differently, and so depending on what kind of system you have. The other issue is, as you mentioned earlier, if you're doing that in your yard and I'm not doing it next door in my yard, my mosquitoes can just fly on over and see you.
So I ask again, why not just spray everything?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people would object to that, as they did with the cankerwort spraying. People don't like the idea of having all this stuff in the air that they're breathing. Okay. We'd also wipe out a lot of beneficial insects, you know, bees, butterflies. Okay. We like those insects.
And mosquitoes play a role in the ecosystem,
yes.
Do they not? Okay. In May, it was reported that for the first time, a person in the United States was carrying bacteria. Now we're moving on from virus to bacteria, very different things. That is resistant to antibiotics of last resort. That would indicate that these bugs have been present in other parts of the world. Why? And this is recent, isn't it? That we've had these super bugs developed that are resistant to almost everything but the final antibiotic we have in our weapon arsenal. Why?
Well, it's become an issue over the past 10 years. We've seen gradually increasing resistance over the past decade and probably even, you know, since antibiotics were introduced. The primary reason behind it really is abuse and overuse of antibiotics when you don't really need them. When bacteria are exposed to antibiotics, you know, they develop mechanisms to survive in the face of antibiotics. So we kind of wipe out the easy-to-kill bacteria, and these ones that have mechanisms of resistance, we've, through kind of multiple courses of antibiotics and huge populations, allowed to grow and grow over time.
Mm-hmm. In America, this one case in America, what was the bacteria that caused the problem?
So the case in America in Pennsylvania was a bacteria that was resistant to a last line antibiotic called colistin. So luckily, this case was sensitive to other types of antibiotics. But the concern is that colistin traditionally has been kind of really our antibiotic of last resort. And if we start seeing bacteria that are resistant to our very last line antibiotics, we really don't have options beyond that.
These are miracle drugs, these antibiotics. They've often been described as miracle drugs prior to their invention or to their discovery or whatever you want to say. The world was a very different place. What exactly are antibiotics?
So there's tons of different antibiotics out there. They work by different mechanisms, but essentially through different mechanisms, they kill the bacteria, and specifically bacteria, not viruses, not other types of things.
But what are they? Are they derived from? Are they man-made chemicals?
Penicillin was kind of first a kind of mold-like product, and they figured out that it killed bacteria and then began to develop it. Most of them at this point are man-made materials. They're different. They attack different components of bacteria. So different antibiotics, different kind of compositions.
And what is it about these so-called antibiotics of last resort that make them the last resort?
So colistin in particular is kind of what we call a detergent, so it pokes holes in the bacterial cell wall. Because that's its mechanism of action, it also can have significant toxicity in patients. Mm-hmm. So we haven't used it a ton unless we absolutely have to. So when we're having to use those antibiotics, and even those antibiotics don't work, that's when we've gotten to a very scary point.
And is that what makes them the antibiotic of last resort? Because they're rarely used, the bug hasn't seen it before and has not developed defenses.
Yeah, I mean, pretty quickly, whenever a new antibiotic is developed within a couple of years, without fail, we've seen resistance develop to that antibiotic. The drug pipeline from the pharmaceutical companies has not kept pace with the ability of bacteria to develop resistance to antibiotics.
Why not?
It's not a moneymaker.
Too busy advertising on television for things we don't need?
Well, so drug companies make a lot of money off a drug you take every day for the rest of your life. Antibiotics, our entire goal is to give you as short a course as possible for as few courses as possible. So Yes. That's not the drug company's dream drug.
But why not? You see, that's the whole business plan of Walmart. I mean, that is. It's a turnover of a lot of people buying the same thing over and over and over and over again, which is how antibiotics work, right?
Right, but then we're also losing functionality of the antibiotics, right? Penicillin, our first drug from the 1940s, there's almost nothing that penicillin works for these days, or very few bacteria it works for.
Colistin, you mentioned colistin. It's the antibiotic of last resort for particularly dangerous types of superbugs, including this family of bacteria known as CRE, mm-hmm. which is also referred to by researchers as nightmare bacteria. They've been known to kill up to 50% of the patients they infect. And the CDC calls CRE among the country's most urgent public health threats. What does that mean? Put that into perspective.
So it's kind of related to what we were talking about earlier. If this bacteria continues to spread at the rate it's been spreading, we won't have treatment options available for patients that have infections with this, obviously. Huge rates of mortality, morbidity on patients.
And the health officials say that this means that, and I quote here, the end of the road isn't very far away for antibiotics.
So if the CRE organisms, so these organisms that are resistant to carbapenems and this colistin-resistant strain that was seen in Pennsylvania, if those merge up, we have no antibiotics to treat a patient that has infection with that. And if that spreads from one patient to another patient in hospitals and other settings.
I think the issue is our ability to kill these germs is suddenly much less than it used to be. The one thing that it is important to bear in mind is that, you know, people's bodies often have the ability to fight off various infections on their own. So it may not be as dire as sometimes it sounds. But when we start to lose our ability to kill some of these germs that cause many of the infections, that is very frightening for all of us who know even a little bit about this topic.
Well, most of us, most people listening, most people alive today have not been alive in a time when there weren't antibiotics at doctors' disposal. So what does that world look like? What did the world prior to penicillin look like? What will it look like now if we end up in a world that has no antibiotics that work?
Well, Well, I think that's why it's important right now to take action to minimize using antibiotics when we don't need it, to not treat every virus with antibiotics. What it means for individual patients with these infections that are resistant to all types of antibiotics is essentially, you know, surgical cure. So if the infection's in the leg, you cut the leg off. You have to get rid of the source of infection is really the only way to treat it, or the body's innate immune system, because the person is healthy, will fight it off.
But simple things like strep throat, I think that's something that you give an antibiotic for, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, so if luckily, though, we do have things like vaccines. So, you know, when you think about the amount of suffering we saw from illness, you know, in the last century, some of these were childborne illnesses that we have other ways to control. And this is a good opportunity to really reinforce how important vaccines are. So we wouldn't go back to the days of, you know, mass mortality amongst very young children, because we have other tools. And vaccines is another one of the very important
things. Health officials have been aware of this ever diminishing ability of antibiotics to treat certain conditions for a long time. And hospitals, I think, have been dealing with this CRE bacteria for a decade now. Why hasn't there been a stronger push to better control the use and the misuse and the overuse of antibiotics?
I think hospitals have been trying for quite a while to do that on the individual level. I think, you know, what we're learning more and more, that the individual level is not enough, that we have to work as communities.
Well, it's not just hospitals. I mean, we've done show 3 or 4 years ago. We did a show with an epidemiologist or a research scientist about the use of these antibacterial soaps that you can buy in the grocery store, mm-hmm. which are terrible products. I mean, why haven't they? Because you use them, and they do kill bacteria on your countertops and other surfaces, but they only kill the weakest bacteria. And so you leave the strong bacteria to colonize even more on these surfaces, and that becomes even more dangerous. Why haven't they been banned? Why are they still being made? Why haven't we been warned? Why aren't there health officials saying, don't buy this stuff?
It's a good question. I mean, you know,
why are we still feeding cattle and sheep and hogs and chickens antibiotics up the gazoo? I mean, why are we still doing that?
I would say that's probably the place to intervene more than the disinfectant type things. I mean, you know, I see the use of antibiotics in animal grains is a much bigger threat around this issue. And then sort of the indiscriminate use of antibiotics in humans. I think there are lots of things we could do, but probably focusing on those areas is going to be the most effective as far as turning this around.
And I think, you know, individuals don't see the bigger picture. They're like, I'm not going to get this resistant bacteria, and I want my big fat piece of chicken that's had antibiotics. You know, I think it's the lack of ability to kind of see the trends over time in the big picture. There also hasn't been a ton, you know, we're starting to get into, like the president over the past couple of years has supported action plans for antimicrobial stewardship programs, controlling these multi-drug resistant bacteria. But, you know, funding for real ways to do that has been very limited and put us at a deficit.
Aren't there antibiotics in the drinking water?
So there are
they're not put there by the cities and the municipalities that clean the water. They simply don't filter them out from upstream where people are excreting them, having taken them in either through eating antibiotic-treated foods or antibiotics that they take from a pill container. They're still in the water, right?
There have been studies that show water sources can have levels of bacteria, especially if they're in runoff areas from things like farms or, you know, where the exposure to antibiotics can kind of feed into the water system. So that is possible. There have been studies that show things like chicken in the grocery store a good chunk of the time have bacteria growing on them that are these drug-resistant bacteria. So there are multiple sources out there.
But what I'm getting at is that if there is antibiotics in the water we're drinking, isn't that part of the problem? We're getting a constant stream of them into our system. And that's not helping things.
And most of that goes back to the agricultural industry and controlling the antibiotic use in that kind of world.
I'm not sure that antibiotics in the water is sort of a prevalence,
yeah.
But it's a major concern. I mean, you know, we were just, you know, I think actually one of our messages is, you know, we actually have very good water here and people should drink it. So I don't want to discourage people from drinking it for that reason.
The Washington Post reported in May that the Agriculture Department and the Department of Health and Human Services revealed that testing of hundreds of livestock and retail meats turned up this colistin-resistant bacteria in a sample from a pig intestine in the United States. Is there a danger that we could get bacteria, this strain of antibiotic-resistant E. coli from the food we handle or the food we eat?
I think that's a concern. We haven't seen that in general to date, but could happen at some point. It kind of gets back to what Dr. Plesha was saying earlier. The people that we tend to see these highly resistant bacteria are people that their immune system can't fight it off. So it's people that have been hospitalized for a long time that have weak immune systems. It's not, you know, you or me in the general public. There was a study recently that looked at healthcare workers, healthy healthcare workers, and found none of them, even though they had contact with patients with this resistant bacteria in the hospital, actually had the bacteria in their system. So we haven't seen it in healthy populations to date.
People used to get, at the height of antibiotics, people used to get a sniffle and they'd go to the doctor and they would be given an antibiotic even though it's a virus they had, and antibiotics are not effective against virus. Has that stopped? Have doctors slowed out their willingness to just hand a pill to somebody because that's what they want and they think it'll be effective?
I think it's reduced. It's a two-way street, though. I want to be clear. I think that doctors need to be a lot more fastidious about not when they give that antibiotics. But, you know, patients really need to be more understanding about that's what you go to the doctor for, and the doctor, you know, can make a diagnosis about whether this is a virus or a bacteria, and that's what determines whether you get antibiotics or not. So there's a partnership there, and both sides need to be understanding the bigger issue that we need to be more discriminate with antibiotic use.
I want to go back just a second to the Zika virus, because we have a tweet from Leanne who asks, will serum from recovered Zika sufferers be able to be used to treat newly infected patients, as was the case in the Ebola? Can they use your blood as a serum to fight other cases?
To my knowledge, no one has looked at that per se. They likely will look at it to help develop vaccines, see what kind of antibodies are the best representative of immunity to this, but I've not heard of anything being used as serum being used.
That's Dr. Kate Passeretti, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at Carolina's Healthcare System, and also with us today, Dr. Marcus Plesha, Health Director for Mecklenburg County Health Department. Don't overuse antibiotics and clean up your yard. That's the message.
Messages,
that's
yes.
The takeaway today, I guess. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
Charlotte Thompson.